The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
For the last few times I've been here, I've been exploring this topic of delusion. And we've worked our way through various aspects of this topic of delusion, and last week we started exploring particularly the very human delusion. It seems to be kind of built into the way we evolved, and delusion around being a self, being someone, having a sense of self. And the belief that there is a self. It seems to be a very human perspective. It's not something, that's just conditioned into some cultures and not others. It seems to be very core to the way we operate as human beings, that this concept of self comes to mind. And in the Buddhist teaching, this is one of the core delusions that begins to be understood as a delusion. And the way it's expressed typically as delusion is that we tend to take what is not self as self. So this is such a counterintuitive teaching. Just exactly because it is such a shared felt experience. It's like we all agree that we're a self. And it's like we all agree. It's like, okay, if we all agree, it must be right. That's how core of a delusion it is. It takes a real... I think the Buddha had a really clear seeing into his experience to begin to uncover the delusion of this and how it operates in our minds. Now, you know, our modern-day psychology and neurobiology also agrees with this, by the way. There's a book I read recently, which is an interesting book. It's called... What's the beginning part? I think it's just called Self Comes to Mind. It's by Antonio Damasio. And it explores this question of, or this process. Let me just talk for a while. I'm not going to take questions for a while. Can you hear? Okay, good. Yeah, I'm going to just talk for a while. I'm not going to take questions just yet. The sense of self that we experience, how does it come to be? And in Antonio Damasio's book, he's a neurobiologist, I think is what his field is, might be neuroanatomist. He's looking at it from the perspective of evolution too, and the evolution of the nervous system in particular. He starts looking from, you know, single-celled creatures and how they evolve up, and where does this sense of self enter into the picture, and what is its function? And so he begins to see and understand that part of this sense of self is a simple kind of natural evolution of our nervous system. And as a way, essentially, as the organisms get more complex, this is my, like, you know, 5-minute summary of this thick book. as organisms get more complex, think of a single-celled creature. You know, there's not much nervous system there, right? In fact, it's just kind of the organism, the single cell kind of navigating the environment, and right on the surface of that cell, there's all these receptors that give it the idea of what's going to take care of it and what's going to be dangerous. So it moves towards food, it moves away from noxious stuff. And so the nervous system, what nervous system there is, there's not really a nervous system in a single-celled creature, but the protective mechanisms, let's call it, the protective mechanisms for that single-celled creature are very simple and very basic. And as evolution proceeded and beings, organisms got more complex, there needed to be this nervous system to begin to control and to find ways to keep the system safe and keep the system nourished. And in human beings, in fact, there's one piece that I found very interesting is that there's kind of a map of the body in particular, right in the center of the brain, right here, right down the center of the brain. And so the nervous system, the evolution of the nervous system was essentially designed to keep us safe, to keep us protected, to keep us healthy. And so the nervous system, that's a function of the nervous system, to keep the being going alive. This process, right? It's just a process. To keep this process going, to keep this process alive. And in a process as complicated as this one, apparently what the evolution of the nervous system has recognized is that essentially the protection of the whole organism is most efficient when the nervous system protects the nervous system's map of the organism. So there's this map in our brains, and the nervous system is the kind of quickest way to protect this being is to protect the map. And so that is what Antonio Damasio calls the proto-self, the beginning of that sense of self, this map and the organism's kind of winding back to that map to protect itself. That it essentially, you know, right there is the beginning of this coalescing of identity. It isn't, the nervous system is simply, you know, process of firings of, you know, random, not random, of chemicals and electrical impulses. If you take like any little piece of the brain, it's like you wouldn't think that's yourself. Essentially, the map in our brains becomes a kind of a concept, and then the nervous system protects the concept. So the nervous system is protecting a mental construct as the most efficient way towards keeping this being going. So let's jump back 2,600 years and talk about how the Buddha saw this. So the Buddha explored, basically in his own exploration, his interest was around suffering, dukkha. His interest was around exploring what is this suffering, what is this dissatisfaction, this unease, why does it happen? Is it possible to not have this? Is it possible to be free from the suffering? And in this exploration, he, I think, probably pretty quickly realized that there's stuff happening in the world over which we're not going to have so much control. You know, there's people doing things that are not so helpful to the planet, to each other. There's physical pain that happens. There's natural disasters that happen. Those kind of things, he said, you know, that our mind is not going to change those things. And yet what he did discover is that it is possible to be at peace, at ease, even in the midst of whatever's happening. And one of the key insights he recognized is that this delusion around self is a key way that suffering happens. In fact, in one teaching, he even described the creation of suffering, how suffering is created in the mind. He went through a teaching on how that happens. It's called the teaching of dependent origination or dependent co-arising. I won't try to go into that teaching today, but maybe in a couple weeks. It's always an interesting topic to cover. We could talk about that one for a while. So this process he described, he recognized, you know, that sense of it's possible to have peace no matter what's happening. He recognized that a key piece of that is, you know, the key piece of having peace is understanding this process of how the mind creates suffering. And this process of dependent origination, this process of how the mind creates suffering, he described as the identical process of how the selfing, the sense of self comes to be. And so essentially, there's a very famous quote by Dogen. To study the way is to study the self. And here we could also say, because studying in this teaching, studying the self and studying suffering are the same thing. They are. So to study the way is to study the self, or to study the way is to study suffering. To study the self is to forget the self, to recognize essentially its not what we think it is. I won't say it doesn't exist, because the Buddha actually said that the belief there is a self is a delusion. The belief there is not a self is a delusion. So, huh? So this middle way, it's like going through the eye of a needle or something, you know, this middle way of what does it mean that there's not a self and that there's not a self? What does that mean? And he explored this through this process. A process has a kind of coherence to it. You know, you think about a river. I think I talked about the river analogy last week with respect to self. Think about a river. There's a kind of coherence to a river, right? There's a riverbed. There's the water flowing through the river. We come back year after year, and basically you can see the river. And yet, what is the river? I mean, the water is not the same, even second to second. You can't pull a bucket of water out of the river and say, that's the river. You can't really even, I mean, even the path of the river changes. The sediment, the river bottom is also kind of being carried away downstream. So there's no thing you can actually point to and say that is the river. And yet we all understand this river and that river, you know, that there's a process of river. And so in a way there is river. But it's not river in the way we put a kind of something that I can point to and say that's river. When we point to something and say that's X, that's tree, or that's me, we're using concept as a shortcut, kind of saying that's true. And you know, these concepts point to a reality, but that reality is not fixed, not stable, not solid or present or lasting. It's an ever-changing, ever-evolving process. And so it is, and yet it doesn't exist. This kind of in-between place. So what I wanted to mostly explore today is how we explore this teaching. I mean, to study the self, to study the way is to study the self. To to study the self is to forget the self, basically to recognize that what we imagine to be self, what we imagine to be me, what we imagine to be I, is not what we think it is. It becomes seen more clearly as an unfolding process. To forget the self is to become enlightened by the myriad things. That's the last piece of that quote. And so what does it mean to study the self? That's where we begin. I mean, one of the I think hearing this teaching and maybe even getting a little taste of this teaching at times, as we explore in our practice, we sometimes almost apply the teaching before we're ready to apply it in a way. You know, it's like we are experiencing something, you know, recognizing how strongly identified we are with something, and then we kind of use the teaching to say, but, and often we use it slightly wrong. It's like, but I don't exist anyway, so, you know, this whole, you know, thing is like a myth, and it's like it doesn't exist. So we try to lay that on top of our experience, rather than what the suggestion is. Study the self, rather than trying to bypass the self by applying this idea of not self. Study the self. What is it that you take to be self? And so let's hear some of this. Just, you call them out, I'll repeat them. So in anybody, just what is it that you, like in this moment, is there a sense, what is it that you take to be self? Yeah. Not self you take to be self. Okay?
Vast space
he takes to be self. Okay?
And not self.
I'm sorry?
The group to which I belong.
The group to which you belong. Say a little more.
Well, the group defines to some degree what I think of myself.
I see. Okay. So kind of, okay, the relationships you have. So it might be family, it might be work, it might be community, that kind of thing. And that there's a sense of self related to each of those.
Yes.
Okay, uh-huh.
Gender,
okay.
The part of me that's aware of my flow of experience.
Okay, the part that's aware of the flow of experience. Uh-huh. The awareness or the witness, essentially. Uh-huh.
The body.
A big one we often identify with. Anyone else?
The mind.
Especially like, there's many aspects to the mind. Are there some specific, let's tease this out a little bit. In what ways do we take the mind to be self?
Consciousness,
just the knowing. Just being, the sense of the knowing. Yes, the mind. The mind choosing consciousness. So,
and you have to be aware of that.
And the awareness of that. Yep. Uh huh.
If you're not, then you're not living in the real world.
Any other aspects of mind?
Intelligence.
Okay.
Memories.
Perceptions, and feelings. So. Let's slow down a little bit. So memories is an important way, I think, that self is
perpetuated,
believed. The fact that we remember when we were 5 and when we were 10. You know, the fact that this mind-body process has memories of a process, and often through concept, you know, I was 5, these were my relationships, this is what happened, I was always X or Y, and there's a sense, in a way, the memory creates a sense of continuity. That's all. I think the memory is where the sense of the continuity comes in. And then we had perception and feeling. Perception is actually very related to memory. Perception operates in a very basic way, in this moment, recognizing I'm sitting in a room. That's perception. That's there's actually what the experience is form and color, and the echoing that I hear from the sound, the mind turns that into, based on memory, based on the past, concepts of people and chairs and floors and walls, and we often actually relate. This is a huge place of how the confusion around not only selfing but many other kinds of suffering happen, that we often end up relating to our experience through the concept rather than through the direct experience. And this is like incredibly useful. I mean, if I were to walk in here every single time and have to figure out, oh, right, that's a chair. Oh, right, that's a person. That's a microphone. Oh, right. It's like, how much energy would that take? It would be hugely exhausting. And so the mind quickly, very quickly, in a split second, does this identification and recognition. The place that this creates a problem or an issue is that we tend to, in that very quick identification, bring in a whole bunch of stuff that's been associated with that. Like, we have relationships with the various people. And it's not just about that person in this moment. It's about that person plus everything that I know about that person and my relationship to what they did 10 years ago or yesterday, and that all comes along with that concept. So we are seeing that person through not only just as they are now, but also through the entire set of ideas we have about them. And we don't tend to see that, and so we take what we are, that concept, as the reality. This same thing happens for self. Essentially, this the sense of self becomes a concept through which we are seeing ourselves. Much as I just described how we see others, sometimes it's easier to see it in that way. That when we see others, we can kind of see the baggage we carry along. It's very similar for ourselves. Like all those memories from when we were 5 and 10 and teenagers, it's like how people related to us. It created concepts of who we are, what we're capable of. And we're seeing ourselves now through all of those filters.
What do you associate with that self?
I'm sorry? What do I associate with? I think one of the biggest ones for me is, it hasn't been named yet, is the ability to choose. The intention to choose, the
channel in your
mind. That just in any way that we choose. There is an agency that happens. That thirst arises, and the there's an intention to alleviate that thirst, which then leads to taking action. This is all choice. Leads to taking action to get some water, which leads to the action of drinking. Even in this very subtle level, it's not even about necessarily changing the channel. It's simply about moment to moment, the mind taking action on experience that comes in. And this is a nervous system function. Experience, like just the simplicity of thirst. I've not had water for, I had a sip at 10:05, and thirst is here at this moment. And so this is a body phenomenon, that thirst arises. This leads to the intention to satisfy that thirst, to get some water. Again, the body taking care of itself, the body and mind taking care of itself. And what happens, so this is just a natural process. There's thirst, I see it. There's cats in my backyard, and I see them. This one cat came in the backyard yesterday. It seemed to be thirsty. It started licking the hydrangea. You know, it's like, wow, I've never seen a cat lick a hydrangea before to get water. You know, it's like the body knows how to take care of itself. It finds water. The cat beeline to where there was water. My watering system had gone on. The petals in the flower had gathered water. The animal found the water. So it doesn't necessarily take a me to figure out where to get the water. And yet we create that sense of me. That me is... Wait just a second. I know. Let me finish my thought and then I'll take some questions. So that essentially what the sense of self is a concept that's been created through memory, through choice, and that's applied. That concept is how we then see our experience. And so just as in our daily lives, walking into a room and seeing chair and floor and not having to reconstruct it each time, it's actually a very useful concept, the sense of self. It's not the enemy. The sense of self is not the enemy. Not understanding the sense of self will create suffering. Okay, so I feel like there's a lot that I haven't explored yet. Like, how does the sense of self create suffering? And how can we look at the self? And yet there's a lot of questions. So, you know, maybe this conversation carries on. We'll see. Okay, so Bill first and then Peggy.
Well, I just wanted to comment on another aspect of mind that occurred to me, which is imagination.
Imagination. That's in the realm of memory, and it's not the past, but it's the kind of the mind that can create. And that's a very powerful process in the mind, the kind of modeling, essentially. That's what imagination is. It models the future.
It follows patterns.
It follows patterns, yes. So the
or creates new ones.
And creates new ones. So the based on memory, based on what's happening, the mind will very naturally kind of filter out and look at possible futures. It's also connected to intention because the mind, like, plays intention forward. What if I do that and then that and then that? You know, so it, like, plays intention forward in down one scenario. Maybe it likes the end result, so that, ooh, let's go that way. So, you know, that this is you know, in the mind, the mind is creating this, you know, has the capacity to model forward and look at a result that it's created in the mind and make choices to take action on that or not that, depending on what's happened. And yes, that I think that's also related to agency. You know, when imagination happens, do we, you know, the sense of I'm choosing this one over this one is a pretty potent feeling, you know, that I'm in control.
The architect, created that building.
I created it and I'm in control. Yes, so now Peggy.
I forgo my question to hear how the sense of self creates suffering.
Okay. So a little bit about how the sense of self creates suffering. When we identify with things, especially I think a lot around the feeling of control, and the Buddha actually highlighted that one, the control piece. He said, This is a big one, you know. This is a big place of where suffering happens. We feel like, you know, the sense of self is very often tied to this feeling of I'm in control. I can choose. I can create. I can architect and create a result. And there is a process in the mind that does that, as we've just described. It does that. The mistake is in attributing a controlling entity is that's there doing that. And how does that create suffering? Well, when that process, that controlling process, gets a result that that process wants, it doesn't seem to create suffering. Although there's a subtle kind of suffering that happens there, which I'll talk about in a minute. And yet when that controlling process runs into the inevitable that control over environment, over body, over consciousness is not always possible, that solidification or identification around that process, that I'm the one in control, I should be in control, it feels good to have that sense of control. It's a really good feeling. I think that's one of the key things that feels like me, is that I did that. I accomplished that. I made that happen. And it feels good, especially when it's something we like or we want. When that doesn't happen, when we don't get what we want, when it's proven actually that things are out of control, rather than taking that as being right, oh, that's the way things are. Things are not ultimately under control. That kind of identity around I am in control, which has, you know, taken up this notion of a lot of other things get congealed to that identity, like it's supposed to be this way. I'm supposed to be able to control things. And when we can't always control things, boy, do we suffer. And it's not about... There can be some objective, like unpleasant experience that happens when things are out of control, like the body. You know, the body, and the way the Buddha put this is he said, you know, the body is not self. If the body were self, it would be possible to say of the body, may my body be thus, may my body not be thus. But the body is not self. And so it is not possible to say of the body, may my body be thus, may my body not be thus. And he went through that through quite a few mental aspects of our experience as well. And so, you know, with the body, you know, there may be, you know, sometimes we can control things. Like I can, because I'm not bound and gagged, I can get myself water. I can slake that thirst. So there's that sense of the process being able to take care of itself. If I were incredibly sick, I might not be able to get myself water. You know, the slight unpleasantness of the thirst leads to the process of wanting to alleviate the thirst. And when that happens, when that unfolds, there's that subtle sense of, yes, I can do that. Even if it's like way below the surface of our conscious recognition that I did that. But all through our day, that kind of thing happens. Yes, we're thirsty, we're hungry, we take care of the body in this way. Now, if I get a serious form of illness and I'm bedridden and cannot take this action to alleviate my thirst, that slight unpleasantness of thirst probably gets exacerbated by a lot of panic, by a lot of confusion, by the sense of fear. What if somebody doesn't come in the room to be able to offer me water? So that because that sense of control is basically taken away, you know, the sense of self begins to panic around that. And the possibility, I mean, so yes, there is an objective level of suffering, both of the body in illness and an objective level of unpleasantness, let's say, both the body in illness and in the thirst. And yet the sense of self, the identification with I should be able to control or fix or change, adds a tremendous amount of mental pain on top of the physical unpleasantness, the mind kind of reeling from not being able to control or fix or change. It is possible to just be in that experience, recognizing this is the experience, it's possible to witness the changing, pleasant, unpleasant flow of experience in body, the changing flow of experience in the mind, without contracting around it, congealing around it, identifying around it.
You choose joy.
You can choose equanimity also. And it's not you choosing it. The mind can choose not to suffer.
You know why? Because joy is harmless.
and equanimity.
Balances it.
So
joy is harmless.
Mm-hmm. If it's not clung to. So that was a kind of an overview, a theoretical description of how the sense of self causes suffering. Let's talk about some specific kinds of senses of self. I'll give an example, and then let's see if we can hear some other examples from the room of when a sense of self created, or you could see how a sense of self participated in the suffering that you are experiencing. And so I was on retreat, and there was somebody in the room in the mornings. We had a kind of a Q&A period, and somebody in the room who asked these questions, and the way that person asked the questions really triggered aversion in me, and a sense of argumentativeness, and it kind of joined up with my analytical, intelligent, aversive, those three combined, sense of who I was. And, you know, it didn't just last while that person was in the hall asking the question. I carried that whole thing out the door into my walking meditation and continued the argument in my mind while I was doing walking meditation, and recognized in all of this, you know, actually how much suffering there was. Because I had, you know, it's kind of the contrast we see on retreat particularly, you know, doing walking meditation. Sometimes there's a lot of ease and peace, and then the contrast of when you're carrying a sense of, and it really felt like a sense of me, you know, it was a very strong identity of I'm right. Self-righteousness is a really powerful way that we sometimes feel a sense of self. I'm right, that person's wrong, you know, and just trying to justify my arguments in my mind to this other person. It's like this whole conversation happening. I mean, I never even met this person. I don't even know the name of that person, but I'm having these long conversations with that person, and I am recognizing the mind is not at peace. The mind is not at peace. So there was an awareness there of that, and an awareness that that kind of whole coalescing around the identity of intelligent, right, know what I'm talking about, and aversive created that experience of non-peace. And so that's an example from me of how that sense of self led to suffering. So others out here, anybody have examples of when sense of self? Yeah, use the mic.
I'm just struggling with letting go of identities that I've carried with me, and that builds up the sense of self for me, and some of them are positive, and there's a few I've allowed in that are not. And I've had some, I've been able to do some of that. But I think that for me, that seems to be the road for me to go, is to not remember things that were awards or what is or whatever. I don't get awards, but anyway, that's the term I came up with. And
so say more about how that creates suffering.
Well,
there's a sense of yes, I'm good, or
yes,
you know,
yeah, and I'm better.
I'm better than. Oh, yeah. Okay. How does that create suffering?
Well, because I know, really, I know that that's not true. I know that that's, I know that that's not true, and that's not only not true, but I want to get rid of that too, because that's an identity that I carry with me sometimes.
So this is the place to take care, and this is the place to study the self, rather than to just say, "Oh, that's an identity. I see it as an identity." Sometimes we do. We really do see that I'm great, you know, as an identity. and then we apply the teaching of, but identity, that's not, you know, that's a place of suffering, so I should get rid of that. And what I'd encourage is to study the experience of, I'm great. What is that? Is it, what is that experience? And the way I've seen this kind of identity lead to suffering, it's not so much right in that moment. Because right in that moment, there's that, again, there's that sense of control, mm-hmm. that sense of people appreciating me, the sense of being seen. There's a lot of that in that identity. And what I've seen the mind do with that is it creates a, it's like a standard.
Like, yeah.
That's the way it's supposed to be. That's happiness. And then as the times go on, you know, the next day or the next minute even, something happens where that bubble of identity is like proven to have holes in it. It's not always true. And you know, then we recognize, you know, so what I've seen is there's kind of, sometimes there's these flip identities. One is, I'm great, and then when something happens and shows, well, actually, I can't always do it. I'm not always seen in that light. People aren't always reflecting that back. Then the identity gets created, I must not be that. I must be a failure.
Go to another state of mind.
Exactly. You go to another state of mind and create an identity around that and suffer around that. And so what I've really seen is in the sense of I'm great, I'm good, it's kind of like what we'd like to do is to have only that identity and get rid of the others. But they are intimately connected. The one depends on the other. And mm-hmm. the interesting piece is neither one is necessary to say that's me. It's like conditions are happening now for me to feel for this mind and body to be reflected, for this mind and body to feel joy, for this mind and body to have appreciation, for this mind and body to accomplish something, and without having to make a it's like this, it needs to be like this. And, oh, now conditions are such that, ooh, not reflected. Oh, a little bit of wobbliness, a little confusion's happening. It doesn't need to be a problem if there's not that congealing and coalescing around the identity and saying, it's supposed to be like this, it's not supposed to be like that. So other, do you have more to say about the...
Well, just that's what I liked from... I think the first time I heard you and you used the word skillful rather than good or bad. And that has helped me tremendous, just the changing of my view of things in a different way. It opened a little space for me.
And that points to another piece here that, you know, as I said a few minutes ago, the sense of self isn't the problem. And in fact, you know, it's like essentially Self is a strategy. The sense of self is a strategy. And what we can do is to explore senses of self, strategies that are skillful, but knowing that we're doing that, essentially. Not that we're deluded by the process. And yet we still are, in a way, deluded by the process. I remember when I very first started meditating, very first week-long retreat I went on, 10-day retreat, I clearly saw myself creating an identity as a meditator. I'm a meditator now. And yet, rather than, you know, trying to say, oh, identity, bad, it's like, I kind of recognize, okay, well, you know, this identity, you know, probably I'm going to have to look at this sometime, but right now it seems to be really helpful. You know, it's helping me, like, look at this angry, self-righteous, right, you know, being. It's helping to let go of so much of the grosser forms of suffering. And so, you know, the construction or the recognition of, oh, here's an identity as a meditator. You know, at some point, I'll probably have to look at that. And I have, you know, at many levels, actually, of, you know, yes, I'm the best meditator in this room. And, you know, 10 minutes later, not even being able to be mindful, it's like, oh, you know, I'm not the best meditator in the room, you know. And the suffering over the shift of identity. And so at that point, beginning to recognize, okay, this what's the strategy now? How to meet that? So we do, it's kind of like we can use the sense of self to help us let go of unskillful senses of self. And so we construct more skillful senses of self, more skillful, like the joy, some of the things you talked about as having as a sense of self, the connecting with a witness as sense of self. Those are strategies that help us to overcome some of the grosser ways that we identify with self. And then at some point we have to look at that identity too. And yet the time to do that isn't just when you recognize, like I did when I was at that first retreat, oh, I see, yeah, I'm a meditator now. It's not to say, oh, well, meditator, sense of self, I shouldn't become a meditator. You know, at that level of my practice, not becoming a meditator meant not meditating. That wasn't so helpful. That wouldn't be so helpful. And so, you know, one of the things I often suggest is comes back to the suffering piece, is that when suffering happens, so I definitely began noticing the suffering around the identity as meditator 3-4 years later. That was the time to start looking at it and to look at those pieces of the struggle. And so we'll come back to this, to study the self. You know, what to study the self. So when you have the sense of, there can be strong senses of self, like self-righteousness or, you know, it can be really obvious. When it's really obvious, just kind of be curious about it. What is it that I'm taking to be self here? Is it stable? Is it something that's always been here? Is, you know, the next day you could check back. Oh, yesterday I was observing that sense of self. Is it here today? So just noticing these senses of self that we have, even when they're really strong, they come and go. And what our mind does with that is just assumes it's there somewhere. It's like, it's just in the corner somewhere. You know, it assumes it's there somewhere, ready to be brought out. But what actually happens is that in a moment, conditions come together and the patterns, the habits, the familiar routes that our minds have taken are recreated in a moment. And there is that sense of self being created again. We can actually watch this. We can see senses of self be here for a while. And you can look at this around relationships. You mentioned different communities. This is an interesting place to explore the sense of self. What is your sense of self when you're with family or with a parent? And then, you know, check that out. How does that feel? And then when you're with a friend, where's the sense of being an offspring? Where's the sense of being a son or daughter? You know, it's not there when you're with a friend. What is the sense of self when you're with this friend? How about with this friend? How about with your boss? You know, you really start to see the fluctuating nature of what we take to be self. And that exploration begins to poke holes in the solidity of it's a thing. So that's one of the ways to explore the sense of self. Did you have something more? Okay.
Yeah. That's my sense of self. Sunday I heard a talk on Walt Whitman's Song of Myself. Now, I realize the Buddha was no 19th century transcendentalist, and Walt Whitman was, but it's a beautiful poem about transcending the self, and I was reminded in hearing that talk. So I think worth reading as part of a Buddhist practice.
Yeah, I looked it up. I was maybe a year or so ago I stumbled on it, and there's some really great, it's a long poem, but it's there's some really great pieces to it. I'll look at it. Maybe I'll bring some of that to the next time. So yeah, I think this conversation's not done. We'll continue.
There's time to go silent.
And that's now because it's almost 11. So yeah, I'll continue. I'm not sure from what perspective, but I'm away for the next couple of weeks. I'm teaching retreat for 2 weeks, so I'll pick this up again when I get back, and we'll keep exploring. There's so many different avenues to come at this. And one teaching on those different aspects of body and mind, you know, that we tend to identify with. I'd like to explore that a little bit. Then there's dependent origination. I can explore that piece. So, you know, this could go on for months. So we'll continue the conversation. Thank you.